Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
When someone goes missing, the headlines focus on what happened. But the truth often lives in the smallest details. I'm Sarah Turney. After my sister disappeared, I learned how those final hours, the last conversations, the last decisions can haunt families forever.
And I'm Courtney Nicole. After seeing crime impact my own family, I've learned how overlooked moments, missed red flags, and unanswered questions can change everything.
Together, we're bringing those lived experiences into the work. This is The Final Hours, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios, a podcast that puts the moments before a disappearance under a microscope.
Listen to and follow The Final Hours wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Monday.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
Welcome to Red Handed. So before we get started today, we've had another amazing week. Thank you so much, guys, for everyone who's been leaving us more 5-star reviews and being absolutely fantastic on all the social media platforms that we are currently finding our way through. We just want to do a few very quick thank yous. So firstly, to Home Birth Midwife, who says that I love the camaraderie and banter between the hosts.
Thank you to Review Nickname 18. That's hilarious. Well done. Who said, these ladies walk the line of deference towards the victims and entertaining banter without being flippant. Thank you.
That is important. And then from Murderino87, who says, these girls are hilarious. They cover cases that are a little bit different and not your typical cases that everyone already knows.
And then Word, who said, there's a lot of D's, guys, who says, great storytelling, posh voices. Lady podcasters are always a win. We've been really enjoying that people...
The obsession.
Yeah, it is verging on obsession now, isn't it?
We feel like you guys are fetishizing our voices a little bit and our accents. We're okay with that.
Oh, we're so Hannah's fine okay with that. And also people will say, like, that we sound the same.
I don't think we sound the same at all.
I think...
You make me sound so common. I think you make me sound common as fuck.
How rude.
How rude.
I think, well, the truth of it is, like, Cerise and I, like, we're from the same area of the UK. We're both home counties girls, so we will have similar speech patterns.
But hey, local comp all the way. I was a local comp girl.
I cannot say that.
That's why you make me sound common as fuck. Your face then, I'm like, hey, proud local comp, and you're like,
I got a scholarship, okay, guys.
I was just trying not to get stabbed every day. No, I'm just kidding, it wasn't rough at all, it was fine. And I was head girl, like, I wasn't rough at all.
I wasn't even a prefect. I was told I couldn't be a prefect because I was too much of a loose cannon, direct quote, Mr. Robinson.
Oh, loose cannon, that's quite
aggressive. Yeah, I know.
I got to be head girl of the fucking local comp. That's not saying much.
In a previous episode, we were talking about lying on our CVs, and I do say, well, I don't think I do anymore, but there was definitely a period of time where I said I was head girl, because the head girl of my school went to do veterinary science at Cambridge, and when are we ever going to be applying for the same job?
I love it. Absolutely brilliant. Good. There's a window into our lives.
We also wanted to do a new feature of a social media comment of the week.
Which we just... There's so many to pick from, though. There's so many to pick from. Maybe we should do one each in future.
But for this week, we have one from Mall Podcast, who said that they were driving and they saw a billboard that was mostly red and they thought it was advertising... us.
Red-handed, the podcast. I do like how much we've infiltrated their minds into which they're seeing us everywhere, including on billboards. It's like a cheaper way to advertise, but we did reply to them, if you don't follow us on Twitter, with, we are absolutely flattered that you think that we have billboard money. We don't even have stickers yet because we have no money to put into this podcast right now.
But, you know, who knows? Maybe billboards might be in our future.
Is that the future of advertising? A big billboard?
I don't know. I'll make one. I'll put it on the A12.
Just this big Etsy billboard advertising our podcast. Do you remember Hannah and I went to a True Crime London meetup a couple of weeks ago? You guys might remember us saying, and we saw pictures of the other podcasts that were coming who were all bringing like bags of swag. And Hannah and I both work, like, I think I was averaging about 12 hours a day the last 3 weeks at work. And we saw this very last minute. We're like, oh my God, I sent you a picture of all these swag bags. I was like, we should take something. And you were like, but what? We don't have time. And it's the night before. I was like, what about if I buy some red lollipops and print some logos out of work and sellotape them to the lollipops? There was like silence for a bit on the WhatsApp, and then Hannah replies with just, should we just leave it, yeah? I was like, oh. Thanks. It's hard life. But anyway.
I didn't mean it to be so hard.
No, I loved it. It was so funny. It made me laugh. And as soon as I sent the text, I was like, why the fuck did I say that? I don't have time to be doing fucking arts and crafts at work. I have a job.
Do you know what it is, though? You're such a producer, that's why. You're always just like, next, this, next.
I find it hard to get out of the headspace. But then we bring reality to each other, I feel like that's what works. And you are such drama. Not like, oh my God, not in a like, oh my God, you're so much drama. But in a like...
It's fine, I am drama.
A very theatrical person. But anyway, back to today's episode and today's case. So today, we are discussing the murder of businesswoman Sadie Hartley in Lancashire, Northern England, in January 2016. When an affair, a burning obsession, and a meticulous murder plot turned into a brutal killing, described by seasoned police officers as an act of demonic savagery, an orgy of violence. Now, make no mistake, this was no crime of passion. It was a crime of obsession, which left an innocent woman dead, murdered at the hands of her partner's ex-lover. So it's Friday, the 15th of January 2016, in Helmshaw, Lancashire, and 999 receive a call from a woman, an employee of Sadie Hartley's, who asks if they can send the police to Mrs. Hartley's house to check on her because they hadn't heard from Sadie in over 24 hours and they thought that was very weird. So the police head over to Sadie's £500,000 house on Sunnybank Road in Helmshaw, where they found Sadie on the floor of her house in the front lobby, about 10 foot into the hallway, dead.
She was lying in a pool of blood, and it was immediately apparent that it was a murder. Sadie had been stabbed over 40 times in a frenzied attack. Blackburn Police started an immediate homicide investigation, with senior investigating officer, Detective Superintendent Paul Withers, describing the severity of the attack, the extent of the injuries, the level of frenzy like nothing he'd ever seen before in all of his 25 years as a police officer. He said that the ferocity of the attack shocked him. The post-mortem on Sadie found an item stuck in the roll-top neck of Sadie's jumper. It was a barb from a stun gun. She had been shocked with this stun gun and then stabbed to death. Her body was covered in almost 50 stab wounds. It was a horrific attack. The wounds were to her hands, arms, torso, face, and thighs. Such a personal attack, it really doesn't feel like it was random.
No, and the police agreed because in cases like this, they obviously turned their attention immediately to the partner, Ian Johnson, a 57-year-old retired firefighter with whom Sadie had been, you know, they had been partners for a while. They were just planning on moving in together. But Ian had been in Switzerland for 10 days on a ski holiday. And the night she was murdered, Sadie had actually been packing to fly out to join him. So Ian's not really ever a suspect. He wasn't even in the country. The police therefore have to dig around. They find out that Sadie had had an intruder break-in in August and that it had really shaken her. With this being the first time Sadie had been alone in the house since the burglary, had the burglar come back? Or was it someone who knew her? They were really stuck.
All they had was that Sadie, a mother of two who ran her own medical communications business, was last seen alive on Thursday at a conference in Manchester with a colleague. She was in contact with a friend and work colleague at about 7:30 p.m. on the Thursday, but then stopped answering emails, which was unusual. But from the very start of the investigation, the police faced difficulties. Sadie was a rich and very successful businesswoman. They lived in a very large, detached house that was pretty secluded. On the road that they lived, Sunnybank, there were only houses on one side of the street, so there were very few houses that actually overlooked Sadie's. So with little to go on in terms of leads or any sort of motive, There was nothing missing from the house. The police make a press appeal, which also yields little.
But the police do get lucky, because the way that the street was laid out meant that the houses were quite secluded. They didn't overlook each other. This street was full of million-pound houses, and they all have CCTV. So they start scouring through all of the video that they can get from each of the houses from the night of Sadie's murder. When they spot something odd, all of the cars parked in the driveways of Sunnybank Road were Porsches, BMWs, Audis. When they look at the CCTV, they see what they feel is a suspicious car, a blue Renault Clio, that was driving around and parked in the area at about 7:50 p.m. A car that will go on to be absolutely pivotal in this case. But let's come back to it.
Also, there's nothing wrong with a Clio. Everett, this is a solid car.
But I think it stood out like a sore thumb in this road, because it's like a cul-de-sac. You wouldn't just be driving through Sunnybank. You would be going into Sunnybank because you live there or because you're visiting somebody. So I can understand why their attention is drawn to this car. It's not in great condition either. So by this time, Ian has come back from Switzerland, and finally the police get some real leads from him. Ian tells them that when he spoke to Sadie during the week, she had been worried because of something that happened the Tuesday before. So pretty much the day that Ian had left for Switzerland.
Someone had knocked on the door of the house, and when Sadie opened it, it was a person in a baseball cap who handed her a cheap bunch of flowers. I find it so offensive when someone clearly brings flowers to your house that they bought at a fucking petrol station. Like, I find it so offensive.
Especially if it's a fucking
stranger.
Well,
exactly.
That's even more.
But, you know, if it's your boyfriend and you've fallen out and he's done something wrong and he clearly just at the last minute picks up a bunch of flowers at the petrol station, I literally would rather you, like, never returned again rather than gave me flowers from a petrol station. Anyway.
Hannah, I think you need to be more grateful.
Not for petrol station flowers, Saruti.
I mean, I'm not really a flowers kind of girl, but this would kind of freak you the hell out. Some random person turns up at your house and just gives you a bunch of flowers. There's no note. They're clearly not florist flowers. It's a bunch of, like you said, petrol station flowers from a stranger with nothing. No note, no card.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Sadie was really unnerved by this, and she thought it might be linked to the burglary that they had had in August. And then Ian shockingly revealed another lead. He admitted to having an affair with another woman whilst he was with Sadie. He tells the police about an obsessive woman living in Chester with whom he'd had a fling. Ian told the police that her name was Sarah Williams. They had met at a dry ski slope, the Chill Factore. Is that how we're going to say that?
I don't know why there's an E at the end of it. I think it's the Chill Factor, but with an E at the end. I don't know why the E is there.
Fine.
It's in Manchester. Who knows?
Yeah, so it's a dry ski slope with a funny name in Manchester in 2012. They had a brief affair and he broke it off in August when the burglary happened. But an angry Sarah apparently wrote a letter to Sadie disclosing the affair. It is far too long to read out here and it's just an entire page. I typed in like size 9. And it details the affair between her and Ian. So who is Sarah Williams? She was a 34-year-old woman living in Chester, 55 miles from Helmshaw. She worked at a travel company organising ski holidays.
It all just fits together, doesn't it? It's very weird. Ski holidays, he's on a ski holiday, they met at a dry ski slope, they break up in August, they have the burglary. I mean, I'm pulling together points that, like, will not even make any sense by the end of this case, but it's interesting to think about. After Ian points them in the direction of Sarah and says that this might be a potential lead you want to look at, the police check her phone activity and they're able to determine that she was in Helmshaw on the Tuesday Sadie received the flowers. So she buys the flowers, hypothetically, and goes to the house. But why? To clarify who Sadie was, check that she had the right address, and then return 9 days later to kill her? In any case, they have enough to bring her in for questioning. So on Sunday, the 17th of January, the police storm into her house early in the morning and arrest her. There's a really good documentary on this that if you do want to watch, it's on YouTube. I think it's just called The Murder of Sadie Hartley by Sarah Williams. And they show you the, like, police camera footage of them storming into her house and arresting her. And she just sat in bed. It's so weird. Imagine how terrifying that would be. Not that she doesn't deserve it if she did this. So she's arrested and taken to Blackburn Police Headquarters to be questioned, where the police now learn that as well as her relationship with Ian, she's in a relationship with a 75-year-old man. She's 34. 75-year-old married man named David Hardwick. Her neighbours tell the police that he comes over every morning at 5 a.m. And Sarah admits that they've been together since she was 17. So he would have been 57.
That just made me mini sick.
And he's married, and apparently his wife knows it all about it, and he just goes around there for sex. It's very weird and very gross.
But it finally looks like the police have a motive. They look at the text between Ian Johnston and Sarah Williams. They see that he told her 16 months before the murder that it was all over. And this is when Sarah sends the letter revealing the affair to Sadie. This has unsurprisingly caused a lot of drama between Ian and Sadie, but Ian also met up with Sarah to lay into her, essentially, and the two have a blazing row over the letter. But weirdly, I don't like this one bit. Ian says, to avoid any more issues and bombshells, he stays in touch with Sarah, dropping her the odd text. Yeah, fucking right.
What the fuck? That makes no sense.
But there are reports that the two were still exchanging flirtatious texts and explicit photos until just days before the murder. And in the notes app on Sarah's phone, they find essays and essays of fantasy of what she wants Ian to do to her. And she just clearly is fixated with Ian, totally unhealthily obsessed with him. Him just being like, oh, I didn't really want to cause any more trouble, so I just kept talking to her. No, you weren't. You wanted to keep her there for when something went wrong with Sadie. He was just benching her. It's gross.
It's hard to know the extent of what was going on. In the videos of Ian talking about Sadie, he does seem to me like a genuinely broken man at the murder of Sadie. I do think he really loved her, or at least cared about her. But yeah, the whole, like, I'm just going to keep texting you to keep you sweet, that's not real. That's not a thing. But the essays that they find on her notes app, she never sent to him. She's just writing herself. So I do feel like, to some extent, it's a one-way fatal attraction kind of thing. But when questioned about the continued texts, Ian denies that he led her on, as the police accuse him of, telling them that whole relationship with Sarah had just been about sex. But it would later come out just how obsessed Sarah was with Ian. For starters, she had even planted a secret tracking device on his car to follow his movements. Yes, she is clearly very mentally unstable. But this idea of, like, this man who's, like, in this relationship with this woman, he goes and has an affair, he then decides that it's over, and he's like, now I need you to just go away. Like, just go away. Like, I also find that very infuriating to be like, oh, she's such a crazy bitch. I slept with her for, they were sleeping together for quite a while. Brief affair is not true. They were together for like a year. And then to be like, oh, well, it's inconvenient now. Just go away. He's a piece of shit too. But she is not well, mentally well, in how she's behaving. But back to the arrest of Sarah. So they bring her in for questioning, and she tells police that she was at home from 4 p.m. on the day of Sadie's murder, and that she had been sent home ill from work, and that David Hardwick, her 75-year-old boyfriend, had come over for a bit. She then said that he had gone home and that she was alone for the rest of the night. But she's so specific in the interview. She tells them very calmly, very methodically, in great detail, how she went to bed early because she wasn't well, then woke up in the night because the dog was being sick. So then she had to get up and clean that up. There's just so much detail, and it's so weird in the interview. We'll post this on the Facebook group. How weirdly calm she is. Just so matter of fact. It's almost like she's on drugs or something. She's so placid.
Yeah, because this is a 34-year-old woman who's never been in trouble with the police before. She's being arrested in the early hour of the morning in her fucking pajamas and is being questioned for a murder. And she just seems totally detached and just keeps denying it. But the forensics might tell a different story. They find blood in the bath at Sarah's house, and the blood doesn't match Sarah's blood type. Sarah's bathtub had been cleaned with bleach, but this one spot had been missed. They know that if they can just match this blood to Sadie, they've got Sarah, they've got her in the bag. So the lab team, get on it. And we will come back to this, put a pin in it, don't forget it. The police, meanwhile, question Sarah on her relationship with Ian, and her story pretty much matches the story that Ian told. She tells them that they fell out in August, and when the police ask her why, she says he said that I was too clingy, too needy, but I don't think I am. And she also admitted to writing Sadie the letter and said, after getting my letter, Sadie rung me and had a go at me.
And this is when the police probe her and ask her, were you jealous of Sadie and Ian? But she says she wasn't jealous, because they can't have had that good a relationship if he cheated on her with me for 12 months. And again, she seems so calm and apathetic for someone who's never been in custody or in trouble before to now go to be in custody for murder. It's just so weird. But the police now know that they just have 3 days to question and charge her or to release her. So they get to work and they focus on looking for the murder weapon. So they comb the woods and the streams around the house whilst also poring over the CCTV footage. The detectives also now look into the flowers that were delivered to Sadie's house on the Tuesday because they strongly feel that the incident was linked to the murder. The police think that maybe it was like a dry run, but they think the person delivering the flowers may not have been Sarah herself. The CCTV footage shows that it was the silver Astra that came to deliver the flowers. And in the CCTV, when you look at it, it looks like it's a woman and a bald man. The woman was Sarah, but who was the other passenger? So this is what led police to find a woman, Sarah Williams' best friend, Katrina Walsh, because Katrina drives a silver Astra. They first thought, when they look in the CCTV, that it was a bald man. But when they went to question Katrina, they discover that she has alopecia and often wears baseball caps. So new CCTV footage now also shows Sarah buying the flowers in a local shop, accompanied by someone wearing a baseball cap.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
When someone goes missing, the headlines focus on what happened. But the truth often lives in the smallest details. I'm Sarah Turney. After my sister disappeared, I learned how those final hours, the last conversations, the last decisions can haunt families forever.
And I'm Courtney Nicole. After seeing crime impact my own family, I've learned how overlooked moments, missed red flags, and unanswered questions can change everything.
Together, we're bringing those lived experiences into the work. This is The Final Hours, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios, a podcast that puts the moments before a disappearance under a microscope.
Listen to and follow The Final Hours wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Monday.
So the police examine Katrina's phone and discover that she was in Helmshaw on the Tuesday. Couple all of this with the fact that Sadie had told Ian on the phone that it was a woman in a baseball cap who had delivered the flowers. It must have been Katrina. And with that, she went from witness to suspect, and they arrest her. Now, Sarah still denies everything, but their phones give them away. Both Sarah and Katrina's phones ping masts in Helmshaw on the Thursday night Sadie was killed. And when the police tell Sarah they have arrested Katrina, it is the first time detectives say that Sarah looks visibly shocked. So the police now have Katrina Walsh, a 56-year-old riding instructor who had apparently been friends with 35-year-old Sarah since she was 17. Coincidentally, the same as that David guy. When she's brought in, she actually says, "You better tell David because I've been staying at his and he'll be expecting me back." Why is she staying with the 75-year-old man as well?
I don't understand. It's so weird that these two people come into Sarah's life at the same time when she's 17. Maybe David and Katrina know each other. And like, David becomes her boyfriend, Katrina becomes her best friend. Like, it's all just a bit weird and incestuous. We don't know that much about them, to be honest. But now, Katrina, she is a really odd person. In the interviews, she keeps saying she can't remember anything. She tells the police that she has a memory problem and that after three sleeps, she can't remember anything. And she says that she leaves notes for herself and writes in-depth diaries to try remember things. It's like that movie Memento. I think she's seen that movie and that's what she's trying to pretend to be. Because I don't believe her. But despite her three-day memory, she says that she believes that Sarah did it. And by did it, we mean murder Sadie Hartley. Apparently, she believes this because she found a note that she had written to herself. And she felt that that note was telling her that Sarah had done it. This note makes no sense. The note read, "If it all goes up, say by the stream, by the southwest of Debbie's field and high above the southern." It's like some weird poem.
That makes no sense
at all. What does that mean? But it was like a loose page in the diary. And when she finds it, she says, "This is what I wrote to myself that makes me think that Sarah did it." But she said that she also had no idea what it actually meant. And she's just so erratic when they bring her in. She keeps saying, "I have to tell you, I have to tell you what I remember before I forget it." And she keeps screaming that she's terrified of Sarah. And she would have done anything Sarah told her to. But after she calms down and the police question her about the strange note. She said the note was maybe with regards to having hidden something. Maybe the words in the note were about where the murder weapons, so the stun gun and the knife, were hidden.
And suddenly now, she has a memory surge and she tells the police to go and look near where her horse is kept. So the police waste no time and head to the farm where Katrina has directed them. But it's a massive farm consisting of 58 stables, 12 fields and countless sheds. Meanwhile, the investigation team have more CCTV evidence. They now have footage of Sarah leaving her house on the evening Sadie was murdered, directly contradicting her story that she had been at home in bed ill all night. The police also have the CCTV of them buying and delivering the flowers on the Tuesday, 9 days before the murder. So they want to challenge both Sarah and Katrina using all of this evidence. And this is when you see the biggest shift in mood with Sarah. They show her all of the CCTV and she just replies, no comment, to everything. And in the interviews, she's changed from sitting forward and making full-on eye contact with the interviewers. And now she's just looking into her lap and making no comment.
So with all of this evidence now mounting, it is, however, mostly circumstantial. But they dig even deeper. And what they find this old Nokia phone hidden under Sarah's bed at her house. And when they check the call activity, they find that she had called Crystal Holidays, so her place of work, and also Hartley Medical, Sadie's place of work, on the night of the murder. Was it maybe to check if Sadie was still at work or if she'd gone home maybe? And then the phone also gives them another vital clue. Sarah had been calling car dealerships, and the final one that she'd called confirmed that they had indeed sold a car to Sarah Williams, who had paid in cash for, guess what, a blue Renault Clio. The same make, model and colour as the car seen near Sadie's house around the time of her murder. But where was the car now? The police needed it because it was bound to be saturated with blood. If Sarah had killed Sadie, she'd left far too quickly to clean up at Sadie's house. So the car was the key. It was what the police needed to absolutely forensically link Sarah to the murder of Sadie Hartley.
They immediately start looking for the car using the license plate number visible in the picture of the car, and very quickly the license plate recognition software hit a match, but it is a totally different model. So what had happened? The police go on a hunch. Had Sarah made the 3 on the license plate into an 8? And what a hunch, because that is exactly what she had done. She had used black tape to change the 3 to an 8. Now they've realised this and changed the license plate they were looking for accordingly. They find the car. And this time, it is the right car. It's exactly the same one she bought. And it was a critical find for the investigation, so the forensics get to work. Now, back with the detectives at Blackburn Police Department on Thursday the 19th of January, they conduct their first interview with Katrina Walsh. In the footage, before she goes in to be interviewed, she just sits on the floor and cries hysterically.
When eventually they are able to calm her down and get her into the interview room, she says that she didn't kill Sadie, but she knows who did, and she keeps saying that she knows it was Sarah, but she constantly says she can't remember anything, just bits and pieces. She tells them that Sarah wanted to find out where that bitch was and take Ian off that bitch. So Katrina, also after being shown the CCTV footage, admits that Sarah had made her go and give Sadie the flowers. Now, for a woman claiming to have a 3-day memory, she spills a lot of information. She continues, telling the police that she and Sarah had gone on a road trip to Germany to buy the stun gun. When the police show Katrina the picture of the stun gun, she starts screaming, "Germany, Germany, Germany," and she behaves incredibly strangely throughout the interview. But despite all of the information she's giving, they still need to understand what Katrina's role was. And absolutely, I will agree that there are those incidents of people who are clearly vulnerable, clearly mentally not well, being taken in by police, being put under duress and made to give false confessions. The police acted, because you can see all of the footages in this interview of how they treated her, absolutely fairly. She is not being mistreated in any way that you can see. I think it's an act, the way that she's behaving.
I do think it is a bit peculiar, though, for a 34-year-old to say that her best friend is 20 years older than her, and they met when Sarah was 17. That feels quite peculiar to me.
I do think that Katrina is very infantile, and I can imagine that her having been like 30-something, being friends with a 17-year-old doesn't feel too strange. But I think that she has some issues. But when you hear her speak, she's articulate. She's strange, but she's articulate. She's not impaired in any way. She's acting.
I think.
Whilst Katrina was being interviewed, the police get a huge break in the case. The blood sample found in the bath at Sarah's house was confirmed to be Sadie Hartley's blood. And there is absolutely no way you can explain that away. They had her, but they absolutely needed to nail her down. It was time to discuss weapons, injuries, and how she had committed the murder. And police go in on Sarah for 6 hours of interviewing. They need to close every loophole, but Sarah still remains silent and combative. But maybe sensing that the net was closing in on her, Katrina now says that she wants to be interviewed again because she remembers things. How convenient. And with Sarah refusing to speak, this was absolutely invaluable for the police. Katrina now tells the police that she hid a zapper, some shoes, clothes, towels, and a knife for Sarah. The police ask Katrina what a zapper is, and she tells them, I don't know why, but this makes me so uncomfortable.
It's even worse when you watch the full documentary and you watch her say it. It's horrifying.
She tells the police, when she's explaining to them what she means by a zapper, she says, and this is a quote, a black thing with squeezy squeezies, with prongs, and it makes a horrible crackly crackly noise. This is a woman in her 50s speaking like this.
I know, but I do think she maybe has some developmental issues. Okay.
So, yeah, you know, her behaviour and speech is odd. It is quite childlike, as you say. But it does seem a bit fake and exaggerated.
And the police think the same thing.
But in any case, she tells the police that she had been told by Sarah to destroy these items. And now she has a panic attack in the interview. But again, it does seem quite disingenuous. It's very dramatic. I've seen people have panic attacks in real life. Quite a few times, actually. And it doesn't look like what she's doing.
She looks like she's in a movie. You know how in, like, real life, apparently, if somebody gets shot, they don't fall over. They stay standing. But movies, they fall over. So people who are faking things, they copy what they think should happen. And I just find her quite disingenuous.
And she starts screaming, she's done it, and I've got evidence.
It's like she's trying to mimic a sudden memory coming back, and that's why she's reacting in such an overtly, like, outrageous way about it. But with that, the police who were running out of time were convinced that the evidence in this case was compelling enough. So they charged Sarah with Sadie Hartley's murder. But now the hard work would begin, because it doesn't end with the charge. It's the focus and the attention to detail that they now need to show on how the case will be built that will determine the outcome of justice when they go to court. So the police, having charged Sarah, now have a problem. What to do with Katrina? She keeps telling them that she was sorry, deeply, deeply sorry, and that the only reason she hadn't come forward before was because she was terrified of Sarah. They need to understand Katrina's role. So they take her, in a quite like a unorthodox mission, they take her out to the farm that she had originally sent them to, because they'd had absolutely no luck finding anything on their own. And they wanted to take her out there so that she could lead them to the weapon, because that would be totally damning for her and for Sarah. And once at the farm, almost immediately, Katrina starts pointing out where the car keys, the knife, and the stun gun are. And exactly where she points is where they find everything.
And the stun gun they find is missing a barb, like the one found in Sadie Hartley's jumper. They find everything, and Katrina led them straight to it. They now determine that Katrina played a significant and willing role in the murder of Sadie. So they charge her too, but she keeps saying, I didn't. It is truly chilling how much planning went into the murder. And in the building case, the team unearthed even more evidence. When they went through Katrina's house, they found stacks and stacks of diaries. And they meticulously go through the diaries from 2010 to 2015, when they realise that the planning for the murder of Sadie Hartley came much, much earlier than anyone had thought.
The pair, so Sarah and Katrina, had been planning this murder for 18 months, because this is when the first mention of Sadie being taken out occurs in the diaries. Katrina writes that Sarah wants to take the evil bitch out, and that she may take part. She's strangely excited by it. She even writes after the first day of planning, "Wow, I may get to be instrumental in helping remove that awful woman. This may happen. Wow, I'm unexpectedly excited by it. Was buzzed so much I need a Southern Comfort to wind down a bit." She's such a twat.
Who drinks Southern Comfort, seriously?
Oh, basic. And in September 2015, 5 months before the murder, she referred to thoughts of a hit on a motorcycle, and also wrote of using the flag of so-called Islamic State to mislead investigators. Like, she was thoroughly excited by this. Those diaries were filled with plans and plots and fantasies about murdering Sadie Hartley. And this woman, Katrina, had no real link to her. She just wanted to kill. I think the diaries also reveal something in that this kind of infatuation that Katrina has with Sarah. But Katrina, what's really interesting is when you look at the diaries, she's cut things out. She's torn pages out, she's crossed things out, she's redacted whole paragraphs.
So she knew that it was incriminating, obviously.
Exactly.
And the memory problem. Well, she remembered to go back and take things out, and line after line, the bits that are left implicate her further. She writes, "I've been wrapped up today in murder plots, and God help me, I'm going to do it. I have no moral qualms with it. I just hope we don't get caught." Ultimately, the two thought they had planned the perfect murder. But I do think it's so childish, the way that obviously they think that this is the perfect crime. Seriously, an Islamic State flag. Like,
it's such a hard case to understand, because when you see the way that they behave, they come across, and the plot that they put together, it's so childish. But then, don't you find their vocabulary, everything is quite sophisticated? They're not stupid in many ways.
No, I don't think they're stupid.
They're not stupid. And I wonder if it's all an act to be seen as, like, having developmental problems or being a bit slow or having these memory problems. I don't really think that that's the case. And how methodically it was planned for 18 months. They went to Germany just to buy a stun gun. They planned this so much.
But who do you think is the ringleader?
I think it was Sarah that was the ringleader. I think Katrina's, like, a bit like, yeah, let's go do it. Like, a bit frenzied and is, I think, a little bit obsessed with Sarah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but, you know, long and the short of it is they were idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And the police built, it's ironclad, yeah. Really, isn't it? Like, there's no way you can talk your way out of it. And after a trial that lasted 6 weeks, the jury convicted both of murder, with Sarah Williams receiving minimum sentence of 30 years and Katrina Walsh receiving a minimum sentence of 25 years.
There's no, did they do it? It's just the horrifying level to which one man's decision to have this affair and pick the wrong, firstly, to make the wrong decision to do that and then pick the wrong woman to do it, left his completely innocent partner dead. And she didn't know for 18 months that someone was plotting to murder her. That's absolutely terrifying.
I hate it as well. Like, when, like, they never go after the bloke.
No,
like,
no.
I really, as you say, like, Sadie was completely innocent in all of this, but she was made out by Sarah to be this villain. And, like, she's the one that's standing in the way.
Absolutely.
When she had nothing to do with it at all. And it's so, I hate it when stuff like that happens.
It's really tragic. It's such a tragic story. And, you know, like I said, we'll post the documentary on there and you can see Sadie's daughter talking about it. And her, they've just broken their entire family. And by all accounts, Sadie Hartley was an absolutely lovely woman. She was incredibly successful, so wealthy, ran that business. She was 60. She was planning on retiring. Her daughter had just gotten engaged. She was really excited about her daughter, like, having some grandkids soon. She wanted to retire and just enjoy her life. And at that point, after working your entire life to build up to that point, you get murdered by some piece of shit like those two. It's horrifying. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. And next week, we're going to switch it up a bit.
It's Halloween.
It is our Halloween special episode.
Exactly. So tune in for that.
And we're not going to tell you what it is because it's a surprise.
So we're doing a case each next week for the Halloween murder. And we'll be telling each other for the first time, which is exciting. I can honestly say that the case I chose and have done is the only case that I have ever researched for this show that has genuinely given me nightmares afterwards. On that note, we'll see you next week.
Tune in. See you on Halloween.
Bye.
Bye.